From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today on Democracy Now!, sweatshop sellout or better than that? A presidential task force on sweatshop labor reached an agreement this week to curtail sweatshops, but labor groups say the agreement is nothing more than a bit of pro-corporate PR. We'll have a debate. Also, activists march against police brutality in Philadelphia, and an update on U.S. maneuvers for a unilateral strike on Iraq. All that and more here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! This is Laura Flanders sitting in for Amy Goodman here on Democracy Now! First, these headlines. Defense Secretary William Cohen ended his tour of Arab nations today with little sign of support for military strikes against Iraq to force Baghdad to cooperate with UN weapons inspectors. Officials in Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Oman, and the United Arab Emirates told Cohen they did not support military airstrikes against Iraq. Cohen also visited Bahrain, Qatar, Kuwait, and Egypt. No statements were made by officials in those countries, but newspaper editorials condemned U.S. aggression and the continuation of crippling sanctions. Despite this lack of support in the region for military action, Pentagon spokesman Kenneth Bacon said the meetings were what he defined as successful, and that the secretary is, quote, confident that the United States will have the support it needs to take appropriate action to uphold the UN Security Council resolutions. According to the Pentagon, the U.S. has 24,000 troops, an aircraft carrier, and about 170 warplanes and helicopters in the Gulf region at present. That's it from the Pentagon. The Spanish government today approved a request for former Chilean dictator General Augusto Pinochet to be extradited from Britain to face charges of genocide, terrorism, and torture. The approval was announced by a government spokesman at a news conference after a cabinet meeting. Judge Balthazar Garzon, whose warrant against the 82-year-old Pinochet led to his arrest in London on October 16th, had passed on an extradition request to the Spanish government this week. Prime Minister José María Aznar's government has criticized Garzon's probe into human rights crimes committed in Chile under Pinochet's 73-1990 rule in Argentina, saying he lacks jurisdiction. Calling AIDS devastating to the African-American community, officials in Alameda County, California, have declared a state of emergency that they hope will bring in more federal funds. African-Americans account for 41% of those diagnosed with the disease in Alameda County as of the end of 1997, though they make up just 18% of the population. A federal judge in Kentucky threw out a new Kentucky law that banned certain late-term abortion procedures. The judge said the law is unconstitutional and invalid. He prohibited any prosecution of doctors who perform such abortions, which the statute from the 1998 General Assembly made subject to criminal penalties. Physicians who perform otherwise legal abortions could fear prosecution under the statute, and the judge said that is enough to make it unconstitutional. A woman convicted of forgery in Ohio, who says a judge sentenced her to prison so she couldn't have an abortion, filed a lawsuit Thursday claiming her constitutional rights had been violated. According to the woman's lawyer, before she was sentenced, officials in the county jail knew she was pregnant but showed deliberate indifference to her pleas that she be allowed to get an abortion. The woman, who is now about 6 months pregnant, has decided to have the baby. The Justice Department is suing the state of Louisiana over conditions at its four youth prisons, alleged to be places where young inmates have little protection from abusive guards and slim hopes of getting good medical care. The government contends the state's youngest prisoners are being held in solitary confinement, have poor medical and mental health care, and get little educational help to prepare them for life outside of prison. According to the lawsuit, the young prisoners face unreasonable risks of violence from other inmates and staff. The lawsuit follows a 2-year investigation and seeks to force the state to improve what are considered some of the nation's worst juvenile prisons. Peruvian television yesterday aired footage of American Lori Berenson, who is serving a life sentence in Peru on terrorism charges. The images showed Berenson with her family during a visit in late October. It's the first time Berenson has been shown publicly since shortly after her arrest nearly 3 years ago. The video was taken secretly by an amateur photographer. A white sawmill worker was convicted last night of first-degree murder in the burning death of an African-American man after a night of binge drinking. The man's corpse was beheaded. Emmett Kressel had been charged with capital murder in the slaying of Garnett P. Johnson, Jr. The charge carried a possible death sentence. The maximum penalty for first-degree murder is life in prison. The all-white jury acquitted Kressel of a charge of robbing Johnson. Sentencing was set for today. Archbishop Desmond Tutu last night defended his Truth and Reconciliation Commission's policy on apartheid-era atrocities in South Africa, urging forgiveness for the people who were granted amnesty. He called it restorative justice. You're listening to Democracy Now. Well, this is Democracy Now! Sitting in for Amy Goodman. I'm Laura Flanders, joined today, as on every Thursday and Friday, although we missed you yesterday, by Juan Gonzalez, columnist for the New York Daily News. Juan, this is the first time we're getting to talk after the elections. I'm imagining you have many thoughts running through that lifeless mind of yours.
Well, it was a stunning week, Laura. I think the armor of this Republican onslaught that we've been experiencing the past few years is the right-wing Republican onslaught showed a few major cracks, and I think that American politics, at least for the next few years, is going to go through a tremendous resifting and change and fluidity as a result. So I think it was a very positive day for the People's Movement, a progressive movement, a positive week.
Now, one of the things you talked about last week was the Latino vote. Looking in Texas and Florida, there were some interesting things to be learned. What about the rest of the country and that portion of the voters?
Well, I think overwhelmingly there was the main indicator was a tremendous upsurge in voter participation by Latinos around the country, especially in Texas and California. It resulted in California and New York. It resulted in major victories for Democrats. And amazingly in Florida and Texas for Republicans. I think the lesson is that both political parties have pretty much ignored Latino issues and concerns, and it shows that when the Democratic Party attempts to actually address itself to the needs of Latinos, they turn out 85% vote for Democrats in New York and California. And when the Republican Party attempts to meet some of their concerns, it can also get not a majority, but a significant share. I think it was about 45% of Latinos in Texas, although the turnout in Texas was among the lowest in the nation, voted for Republican George Bush. Interestingly enough, I made a remark in a column yesterday that the 2000 election may be the first in American history where both presidential candidates can boast of being bilingual, both George W. Bush and Al Gore, if they are the candidates. Gore has been brushing up on his Spanish for the last year or two and is now actually pretty fluent.
Hmm. So not just a boast, but perhaps something real there.
Of course, the content of the message they put out in Spanish is the critical issue.
They can speak out of both sides of their mouths in two languages.
Absolutely.
All right, we're going to go now to the international front and get a report on goings-on with U.S. relations with Iraq and events yesterday at the United Nations. The U.N. General Assembly has been grappling with a decision on whether to authorize the use of force against Iraq for its noncompliance with U.N. weapons inspections. Washington has signaled, meanwhile, that it plans to move ahead with preparations for unilateral airstrikes against Iraq in any case. While a Security Council resolution yesterday condemning Iraq's latest actions did not mention the use of force, the Clinton administration says it has ample authority to attack Iraq under previous UN resolutions. Several council members yesterday cautioned against using military strikes. We're going to hear more about that in a moment. Meanwhile, just to recap for people, Iraqi President Saddam Hussein cut off corporations with the UN weapons inspections last Saturday, saying he was ending all dealings with the UN Special Commission composed of a group of weapons inspectors, some of whom he had difficulty with. The decision surprised a lot of people because for the past year, Iraq's been lobbying hard to have economic sanctions against it lifted. With us to discuss what is happening in Iraq and what the U.S. might do is Farhan Haq, UN correspondent for the Interpress Service, a third world news agency. Farhan, this did come. Let's start first with the resolution last night. Can you give us the flavor of the debate and some of the more notable comments?
Well, first of all, it really is a mixed victory for the United States and for Britain, who wanted the resolution in the first place. On the one hand, they did get a condemnation of Iraq's decision on Saturday to cut off cooperation with the UN inspectors. But on the other hand, they didn't even get a phrase such as severe consequences or consequences, which is the normal United Nations diplomatic speak for whenever they want to authorize some use of force. The resolution didn't mention that on the one hand. And on the other hand, at China's insistence, they even cut out a phrase that said that the situation in Iraq continues to pose a threat to international peace and security. China didn't want that phrase because they thought that that itself was a tip-off, a sort of rationale for any unilateral action by the United States. And as China, France, Russia, and Bahrain, which was also sitting on the council this year, made very clear, they're not at all in favor of anything outside of a negotiated settlement, such as perhaps further talks between the UN Secretary General, Kofi Annan, and Saddam Hussein.
Was it significant, the position of France and Russia, given that they historically, or at least in the last year, have acted as kind of brokers between the U.S. aggression in Iraq?
Well, I think what the U.S. might find significant about it is that for the first time, both Russia and France are actively criticizing what Iraq did. For example, the French ambassador, Alain Desjardins, said that the decision by Iraq last Saturday was irrational and unacceptable. And even the Russians, who have normally been the ones to plead for democracy, were not in favor of that.
So are we seeing then a continued erosion of the U.S. attempt to isolate Iraq internationally?
Well, that's been happening for several years, and particularly the significant event was this February when Iraq actually expelled the UN weapons inspectors. The U.S. Prepared for military strikes, but couldn't find any Arab state in the region, not even one, not even Kuwait or Saudi Arabia, with which the U.S. has helped out and arms militarily, were willing to condone any attack. And the main reason for that is basically that the Arab states, Russia, France, and many third world countries around the world simply do not believe that the United Nations will ever lift the sanctions on Iraq, which have been running for 8 years now, and which the United States in particular is very adamant against lifting.
But it seems, at least in terms of the position, the public viewpoint of the U.S. government, that they're pressing more on the fact that they've been able to establish some base areas from which to launch a possible attack. So they're constantly trying to put the spin that they're getting support. What's your view in terms of how that is playing in the rest of the world?
Well, I mean, the U.S. with the rest of the world on this is a little bit like the Republicans on the Monica Lewinsky affair. They feel that any moment now the rest of the world is going to come around, but they have to avoid overplaying their hand because very probably it's not going to happen. In fact, William Cohen's trip to the Middle East this week has shown that even though there's increasing criticism of Iraq by some allies, no one wants a military conflict because all sides believe that that's going to just push them back to square one in terms of the effort that's been very laborious among diplomats this year to try to get the sanctions lifted. In fact, the Saturday decision by Iraq to cut off cooperation occurred just one day after the U.S. made it very clear at the United Nations that for Iraq to get the sanctions lifted, they have to do more than simply to disarm themselves of chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. Right now, most countries, I think, are in the position of saying, if Iraq gets rid of all those weapons, if we can prove, if the UN can prove that those weapons have been destroyed and are not being constructed elsewhere in Iraq, the sanctions should go.
What about the voices of support that have in the past been raised on, if not in, on Saddam Hussein's behalf, at least in sympathy with his resistance to the inspector's apparent infringement of Iraqi sovereignty?
Well, Iraq has had some mixed fortunes of late about this. On the one hand, I think some of their neighboring countries have been worried at reports that Iraq tried to place VX, which is a very toxic chemical weapon, inside warheads. And the UN inspectors, in fact, have concluded that at least among some warheads they found in a graveyard in Iraq, that there were in fact traces of VX gas, which certainly doesn't cheer that many countries who have been supporting Iraq and who have been saying, look, they're trying really seriously to get rid of their arms.
So you think there's been a significant shift there, and we certainly aren't hearing the voices that we heard 6 months ago from the region.
Well, but it goes both ways. On the other hand, Iraq has had some good news in the Arab world in that Iraq has for years been saying that the UN inspectors are biased in favor of the United States, that they're biased in favor of Israel. And in fact, recently, a U.S. member, ironically enough, of the U.N. inspectors, Scott Ritter, who is a former Marine, in fact, resigned from the U.N. inspection team, UNSCOM, and he criticized them of going too soft because the U.S. no longer wants to provoke conflicts with Iraq, which, of course, implies that for years that's exactly what they've been doing. And in fact, Scott Ritter's allegations and the fact that he himself is being investigated by the United States on charges that he shared information with the government of Israel have damaged the credibility of the UN inspectors among the Arab world, which has made the case for the use of force against Iraq among Arab states much harder, in fact.
What do you make of recent reports that Congress turned down funding for continued opposition movements within Iraq?
Well, it's strange because the U.S. for a long time tried to turn its back on some of the more credible opposition forces, because what their strategy was for a while was to see whether they could get some people, some top military officials, some people within Saddam Hussein's regime to turn against him. And that tactic, of course, has failed. Normally, whenever any of those officials started to cozy up to the U.S., Saddam Hussein found out very quickly and executed them, which basically ended the threat for him. And actually, in that respect, the previous effort not to try to align themselves with the democratic opposition has created a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, where now they say, years on down the line, well, the democratic opposition isn't that successful, so why should we give them some help?
Mm. To go back to the military prospects here, the U.S. at the moment, according to the Pentagon, has the aircraft carrier Eisenhower and 20 other combat and support ships in and near the Gulf, including 7, I think, capable of firing long-range Tomahawk cruise missiles that could hit Iraq. It has 174 aircraft in the area, including 50 on the Eisenhower. Is this a radical change, that this kind of capability is now floating in the Gulf and does not require any territorial base from which to launch such an attack, therefore taking, I would imagine, any kind of weapon away from the regional states with their approval or denial of that kind of permission for a launch?
Well, it does actually give the U.S. a little bit more flexibility than they had in February. It's not precisely a first. They've always had some aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf. They've never relied so heavily on forces that didn't need to be based on land. You know, in many ways, that's simply just a recognition of the fact that they know that they're not going to get permission to use bases on land, like Dhahran Air Base in Saudi Arabia or Incirlik Air Base in Turkey, which are the traditional areas where the U.S. has launched attacks on Iraq in the last few years. On the other hand, it doesn't help them that much, because there's also political repercussions. They do not want to hold any attack that is going to lose the Arab world, particularly right now when they've tried for months to win the support of Arab nations back, particularly last month by bringing Benjamin Netanyahu and Yasser Arafat together at Y, Maryland for the peace talks. Mm-hmm. They were hoping that those peace talks would in fact improve the situation, but since they have not done so yet, in many ways, an attack on Iraq could just destroy everything that they've tried to create in the last few months.
Thank you very much, Farhan Haq, UN correspondent for the Inter Press Service. Thanks so much for being with us here on Democracy Now! We'll be back with you in 60 seconds. Justice! Justice! Justice, freedom and justice. This is Democracy Now!, sitting in for Amy Goodman, who will be back with you on Monday. I'm Laura Flanders with Juan Gonzalez. A DNA study published yesterday on President Thomas Jefferson has presented compelling evidence that Jefferson fathered through rape or romance at least one child with a slave, Sally Hemings. Pacifica radio commentator Robert Knight's been thinking about this over the last few days, and this is what he came up with.
What's in a name? Consider this tale of two presidents, Thomas Jefferson and William Jefferson Clinton. Both presidents had improper sexual relationships with unpaid staffers 28 years their junior. William Jefferson Clinton had an affair with Monica Lewinsky, a White House volunteer. Thomas Jefferson had an affair with Sally Hemings, who was anything but a volunteer. In fact, she was his slave. Both presidents denied their affairs, then were caught lying by DNA evidence. William Jefferson Clinton was caught with his DNA on a blue dress while in the White House, whose first occupant was Thomas Jefferson. And now Thomas Jefferson has been caught by his own DNA, which, according to the report published today in the scientific journal Nature, confirms his paternity of Eston Hemings Jefferson, the youngest son of his beloved slave, Sally Hemings. The research was conducted by Virginia pathologist Eugene A. Foster, who, with a team of DNA experts, isolated Jefferson's Y chromosome, which, they said, seals the case that Jefferson fathered Eston, creating a dynasty of Afro-Jeffersons, which no doubt will make for a fascinating family reunion in Monticello. But the two Jeffersons have even more in common than extramarital sex and a wayward DNA trail. Both presidents were Democratic Republicans, as Jefferson's Democratic Party was then known. And both presidents addressed America's race problem with a mix of progressive rhetoric and moderate policies. Thomas Jefferson spoke against slavery, but did not free his slaves as long as he lived. William Jefferson Clinton spoke for affirmative action, but he also oversaw the imprisonment of African Americans in record numbers through the Tough Crime Control Bill he signed. And yet, both presidents enjoy the continuing affection of most African Americans. That paid off handsomely for Bill Clinton with Tuesday's election results, after he spent the crucial last 2 days campaigning for blacks to turn out the vote. Clinton hung out with so many African Americans that one suspects that he, too, might have been one of those black Jeffersons, as Toni Morrison has suggested. The payoff was a record black voter turnout, minus, of course, the 23% ineligible to vote because of their incarceration. They elected so many Democrats across the country that the complexion of Clinton's impeachment problem changed overnight. In other words, the president may not have freed the slaves, but their descendants have freed a president. With their votes, African Americans have effectively emancipated William Jefferson Clinton from Monica Gate and given him a political manumission, certifying his new freedom to seriously address the problems of their communities. The coming months will tell whether Bill Clinton returns the favor. I'm Robert Knight in New York.
Pacifica commentator Robert Knight. This is Laura Flanders sitting in for Amy Goodman here on Democracy Now! With New York Daily News columnist Juan Gonzalez. We're going to move next to an agreement that was signed this week after 2 years of negotiations stalled by months of stalemate. Members of a presidential task force on sweatshops finally agreed on a plan they say will reduce the use of sweatshop labor in the garment industry. Now, 9 of the 18 members of the task force, which included representatives from Nike, Liz Claiborne Corporation, the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, and the Robert Kennedy Memorial Center for Human Rights, reached the agreement, which will set up a code of conduct and a monitoring system for American factories overseas. Though soundly praised by President Clinton, however, the plan does not have the support of labor groups. The Union of Needle Trades Industrial and Textile Employees, better known as UNITE, as well as the Retail Wholesale Union, both of which were members on the task force, decided to resign from it rather than agree to its terms. The Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility, a coalition of religious organizations, also withdrew from the task force. They say it doesn't require overseas factories to pay workers enough to meet even their basic needs, and it allows American companies, that's U.S. companies, to use clothing factories in countries that repress unions and commit other labor-related human rights violations. They also say that the agreement would allow companies to brag that they're producing sweatshop-free products when there are really no assurances that that would be the case. Now, we've got with us in the studio two people who had a close experience with the negotiation process, people who were in the negotiations with this task force. One is Michael Posner. He is executive director of the Lawyers Committee on Human Rights, one of the task force members that did go ahead and agree to the plan. Also with us in the studio, Alan Howard, assistant to the president of the Needle Trades Industrial and Textile Employees Union, UNITE. Let's start with you, Michael Posner. Why do you think this agreement deserved the signature of you and your organization? What did you feel was accomplished this week?
Well, we felt that this was an important first step in building a foundation for holding companies accountable. We've set up a monitoring system, which we think will yield lots of information about what's wrong in factories around the world. And it will give, we've set up a reporting system which is transparent and which will give consumers a basis for making informed choices about the products they buy.
Now, who will be doing that monitoring, just to clarify?
It will be done by independent external monitors who will be accredited by the association. Any entity, commercial entity, non-governmental organizations will all be eligible to apply to the association to become accredited, and there is a standard that they'll have to meet to show their competence in this area.
And how will the travel and the expenses of these monitors be paid?
In the initial years, the expenses will be paid jointly by the companies and by the association. There'll be a shared process. And then going forward, the companies themselves will pay.
Well, we'd like to get the voice of one of the critics, Alan Howard of UNITE. Why did you, at the end, decide not to sign on to this accord?
Well, look, we worked very hard for 2.5 years. We wanted very much for this thing to work. But as you said, finally, the labor and religious members could not go along. On the monitoring, for instance, these monitors are these will in almost all instances be these large commercial accounting firms. They will be selected and paid by the companies themselves. The factories to be monitored will be selected by the companies themselves. And anywhere between 90% and 95% of the factories will not be subject to inspection. Now, under a monitoring system like that, for companies to claim that they're not operating sweatshops, I think, is highly dubious. But as you mentioned, beyond that, there is this wage question. The companies all along refused to commit not only to pay a living wage, but to engage in a serious study of what a living wage would be in different countries and consider that in relationship to the existing code. And finally, there's many things, but the other most obvious thing is, you know, they can go into any dictatorship in the world and claim that workers are free to organize unions, and it's not true.
Well, presumably the Lawyers Committee on Human Rights wouldn't approve of that, would they, Michael Posner?
Not at all. Let me just go back on a couple of those points. In terms of the monitors, who they are will depend on the accreditation process, which will be undertaken by the association. Half of the members of the association will be from NGO labor advocates. And so it's very much in our interest to make sure that the monitors that are accredited are real. Some of them will be companies, some of them will be NGOs. On the question of where, it is up to the director of the association. The final decision about which factories get monitored is up to the director of the association. The companies submit a list, but the association makes the final determination in every case.
Now let's talk to two critics of this accord who were not themselves negotiators but have played a very big role, they and their organizations, in bringing this issue to the boil and acting as unofficial monitors of sweatshop conditions around the world. One is Medea Benjamin, executive director of Global Exchange based in the Bay Area. Medea, your comments on the debate as you've heard it shape up so far.
Well, I agree with Alan. I feel like this is the criteria aren't strong enough. Certainly, we're still in a situation where you can have 14-year-olds working 60 hours a week and getting less than a dollar a day. And the scary thing for us is now these companies are going to be free to start advertising, labeling, marketing themselves as sweatshop free when they're not.
And that's been a possible campaign. It's been a campaign, an effective campaign around the U.S. to try to stop consumer, you know, raise consumer awareness. What about that part of this picture, Michael Posner?
Well, in fact, companies will not be able to label their products sweatshop free. What we've said is that companies have to pass a 3-point compliance test to be part of this association. And that includes, one, that they're doing the monitoring in a serious way. Secondly, that they are remedying problems when they exist in factories. And third, that they're setting up a system to deal with potential problems in other factories. I think we all recognize there are huge problems in these industries, and we're not going to eliminate sweatshops with this agreement. What we are going to do is hold companies' feet to the fire in ways that they're not now being accountable. This is a first step towards accountability. And I think in the absence of alternatives, it's the best way forward.
What are the specifics in terms of the minimum standards? Is it possible to work your employee 60 hours a week and meet the minimum standards? Is it possible to work 14-year-olds? Is it possible to pay below a living wage?
It's certainly possible to work them 60 hours a week. It's possible to pay them below a living wage. And the question is somewhat complicated, but I think what's in the code is consistent with ILO standards, which are not perfect, but...
And ILO is the International Labor
Association. Organization.
We relied in every case possible on ILO standards, and there are 9 criteria in the code, 9 categories. About 6 of them, we found ILO, International Labor Standards, that worked. On the wage issue, which I agree is one of the most important issues, if not the most important issue, it's an issue where there is no international consensus. And our view was we need to push forward on that issue, and what we've gotten the U.S. government to agree to do is a series of studies looking at what are wages around the world and what's the methodology for moving towards a living wage.
That's Michael Posner of the Lawyers Committee on Human Rights. Somebody who has actually tried to bring to the public's attention what those wages are is our next guest, Charlie Kernaghan, with the National Labor Committee. When we talk about livable wages in the countries that we're discussing here, namely Haiti, Honduras, Nicaragua, you name it, what are we talking about, Charlie, and what would it take to bring these wages up to livable standards?
Well, it would cost the companies very, very little. As the accord stands right now, it's true. I mean, you can work 14-year-olds 60 hours a week, but it won't stop there because the wages that are paid are starvation wages. Under this agreement, they can go on paying 4 cents an hour in Burma, 13 cents an hour in China, 9 cents an hour in Indonesia, 50 cents an hour in Mexico. So what you have here are the continuation of these starvation wages.
Charlie, we're going to have to come back to you in just a second. We've been having some phone problems today. One of the statistics that I saw on this story made the point that in Haiti, to bring the wages up from sort of misery level of 8 cents an hour to basic livable wages was only a question of 11 cents to 58 cents. What stopped this presidentially brouhaha task force from making that kind of demand on multi-billion dollar owning corporations like Nike and others?
Let me Michael be clear. Posner. The NGOs and unions that have been part of this process have been resolute that the issue of wages are not going to go away, that this is a low-wage, high labor-intensive industry that is paying people far too little around the world, and we're going to continue to press on that. And what we've said as a matter of priority is that a matter for this association's board to consider is the question of wages. In the code is something that says that wages are essential to meeting basic needs. We never went beyond that. And we now need to go beyond that.
Let's try to get Charlie Cunningham back up now that we have the phone line tried again. Charlie, you there?
Yes.
Okay. Pick up where you were, if you don't mind.
Well, I was just going through some of the starvation wages, the 13 cents in China. The most perfect concrete example would be the co-chair of the task force, the Liz Claiborne Company. It's producing $198 Liz Claiborne jackets in El Salvador in a sweatshop, where workers are working 7 days a week, sometimes up to 15 hours a day. New workers are tested if they're pregnant. If they are, they're fired immediately. If the workers raise a grievance, they're fired immediately. They're paid 60 cents an hour, which meets one half of the cost of living to climb out of misery and into poverty. For the $198 jackets they make, they are paid 84 cents. That's 0.4% of the retail price of the garment. It's a tremendous exploitation. For the workers to earn a living wage, to live very poorly, with no dignity, really, and no savings and no luxuries, they would need $1.18 an hour. If Liz Claiborne paid that $1.18 an hour, the total sewing cost in the $198 jacket would still only be $1.66, which would mean that the labor cost would only be 0.9% of the sales price of the garment. The living wage is very doable. I think this deal that was cut in Washington is like campaign finance reform without touching the soft money. It's a beltway deal, beltway thinking, which won't resonate with the American people across the country. It's not going to matter to the students. It's not going to matter to people in the religious community. It's not going to matter to activists across this country. And frankly, this issue of transparency, which Mr. Posner mentioned a few times, if what the companies were doing was so beautiful and so good, then why do they continue to hide their production? Why won't they give the American people just the names and addresses of the factories that they use around the world? They refuse to do that because they want to keep this stuff hidden behind this Beltway Association. It's not acceptable.
Michael Posner, your response?
I think a lot of the points that Charlie Kernaghan makes are valid. I think he's actually played a very useful role in highlighting the dimensions of the issues we're trying to deal with. The point is we have to have a response to this, and what we're trying to do here is to create a structure, a formula that allows some accountability for companies. In the absence of government regulation, which is not happening, in the absence of a strong international system, which doesn't yet exist, we've got to find some ways to protect workers and to hold companies accountable in a system that the consumers are going to understand. I think we've taken an important first step in that direction. But be sure, these are huge problems. They're not going to be resolved overnight. A lot of hard work has to go forward. And I think people like Medea Benjamin and Charlie Kernaghan helped that process.
I'd like to get Alan Howard back in. And, I mean, because we're dealing here with one of the perhaps critical questions of modern capitalist society, which is this enormous disparity between what the same companies are paying workers in other countries and here. Alan, what do you see in terms of the role of your union and of unions and the ability of the unions in this country to link up with labor unions in other countries to have some kind of a stronger force that would have an impact on these disparities?
Of course, that's the major task that we're engaged in at this moment on the international front. You know, Mike mentioned what we believe is the answer to this problem, which is new laws that would regulate these huge retailers and manufacturers that control 80% of the industry in this country, make them legally accountable, develop trade agreements that have real enforceable worker rights in them. You know, we don't know what's going to happen with this task force. You know, only time will tell.
Just hold that thought one moment, Alan Howard. We will be back with you in 60 seconds. We're just going to take this one-minute break for stations to identify themselves.
Thank you.
we're talking about this week's accord, much praised by the president, of a new pact that at least first glance looks as if it calls on corporations or it sets up a system to improve monitoring and to reduce the use of sweatshop labor in U.S. corporations and others around the world. There's been a lot of contention about the agreement. Many members of the task force that put it together, or some members of the task force that put it together, pulled out of the pact at the last moment. Those were the ones representing labor and the faith community. We have Alan Howard here in the studio of Unite, the Needle Trades Union. Alan, you were talking about where really you take this campaign now. Are you frightened that by having pulled out of this accord, you will be diminishing your power to play a role in this kind of agreement in the future?
No, as I was saying, that you know, none of us have crystal balls. We don't know what will finally come of this task force. We would be the first to want it to succeed in what its intentions are. Whether it's a step toward making a real contribution to the development of a movement in this country capable of getting those laws, enforcing those laws, making these companies legally responsible for the conditions that exist, if that should happen, then it would be a step forward. If, on the other hand, it diverts our attention, creates false expectations, then it would be a step backward rather than a step forward.
Medea Benjamin, I'd like to get you back into the conversation. Your sense of what happens from here on in, both with this task force and with the continuing battle against sweatshops?
Well, I think we have to keep doing what we've been doing from the outside, which is expose company violations of labor rights around the world, support the workers' right to organize. I think the great hypocrisy of so many of these companies is now putting in their codes that they will respect workers' right to organize and collective bargaining, and then running off to China and Vietnam and free trade zones around the world where workers can organize. So I think supporting the right to organize is the most critical thing that we can be doing. And I don't understand a comment that Michael Posner made about companies not being able to market this being part of this Fair Trade Association with labeling, because in the agreement that I'm looking at, it does say that that companies that are part of it shall be able to use product labeling, advertising, and other means of communication to the consumer. So that's the only incentive I see for companies to join this, and I'm confused why Michael said they won't be able to label.
Michael, you have a response?
Sure. I didn't say they won't be able to label. I said they won't be able to use the label sweatshop free. They'll be able to say that they are participating in or in compliance with the standards of the Fair Labor Association. It's quite a different thing, and I think part of our job is going to be to educate consumers and the public about what the difference is.
One last comment to question to you, Medea. This type of a task force takes place within the context of growing globalization of these kinds of agreements and practices, the Multilateral Agreement on Investment, the World Trade Organization, NAFTA, GATT. How does a pact like this relate to the standards being loosened up around the world?
Well, I think that this is a voluntary, self-regulating kind of agreement. A company doesn't have to join this. If it joins it and it doesn't like it, it can drop out of it. We need, as Alan was saying, we need some real trade agreements that have enforceable standards for workers in there. And we're going to move beyond this self-regulatory type of agreements to something that is international and has some teeth in them and really sanctions companies that don't abide by fair labor standards.
Charlie Kernighan, one last question. This reminds me very much of the battle in the early years of the battle against apartheid between the Sullivan principles for corporations, which didn't actually challenge the system of apartheid itself, but tried to get American companies to promise to behave better. What's your sense of what this means in terms of the growth of the movement against sweatshops?
Well, I think you hit it right on the head, because what happened after the whole Kathy Lee Gifford expose was the sweatshop issue was out of the bottle. Child labor, starvation wages, these horrible factory conditions. It was out of the bottle, and the companies could not get it back in again. They couldn't get it back in the bottle, and they're scrambling. I watched them scramble for the last 2.5 years to regain control over the issue, to divert attention from it, to take the focus away from it. And in my mind, standing back looking at this, this task force agreement is meant to take the wind out of the sails of the social movement, which is terrifying these companies. They don't want university students on 50 campuses calling for sweat-free universities. They don't want religious people and congregations all across the country meeting on this issue and asking serious questions. And they need to control the movement, and the task force is meant to take the wind out of the sails. Just like Medea said, we're going straight ahead. Mm. Corporate disclosure.
All right, Charlie, we're going to have to cut you off there, but thanks very much for that final comment.
And thanks, everybody, who participated here this morning. That was Charlie Kernighan of the National Labor Committee. Medea Benjamin was also on the line from the Bay Area Global Exchange. With us in the studio, Michael Posner, Executive Director of Lawyers Committee on Human Rights, and Alan Howard from the Needle Trades Industrial and Textile Employees Unite. Thanks, all of you, for being here on the program. We're going to go next to a demonstration this weekend in Philadelphia on the subject of police brutality. There are other things happening in Philly, too, this weekend. We'll tell you about those in just a moment. Sitting in for Amy Goodman, this is Laura Flanders here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! With co-host Juan Gonzalez this Friday. It's been a week since the Supreme Court in Pennsylvania denied the appeal of death row prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal, and activists from across the country have been holding demonstrations all this past week. This weekend in Philadelphia, people from around the U.S. will gather to demonstrate against the execution of Mumia and also against what they call ongoing police murder, frame-ups, and terror. They say they plan to shut down Philadelphia's City Hall and conduct an African People's Tribunal to try police officers and other officials for their crimes. Among the speakers at the event will be family members of people killed by police and other government officials. We have one of those with us on the line right now. Her name is Barbara Vance, and she's the aunt of Kenneth Griffin, who was killed last year by Pennsylvania State parole officers. Barbara Vance, tell us, if you will, what happened to Kenneth Griffin, your nephew?
Yes. He was in a halfway house, and he walked away from it and didn't report back. He had been gone for over a year, and he came back to Philadelphia to visit his mother. The state probation and parole officers came to his mother's house, burst in and held the family at bay with guns while they barged in the basement and up the stairs at the same time to find Kenneth. They said they had a tip that he was there. So they found him in the basement. They didn't even cut on the lights. They went down with flashlights. He was there with his two children and their mother. They told him to come out, give himself up, because they weren't there to take him back. They were just going to... you know, it was just a formality they had to go through to put him back in the system and everything. So he had jumped out of the bed and went under the bed when he heard the noise upstairs. So he came out with his hands in the air, buck naked, you know, and everything, because he was asleep with his family. As he went to come around the edge of the bed, they had told his children and their mother to get the F out of the basement. As she grabbed her children and ran between them, they just opened fire on him, parting one of the children's hair with a bullet. These were 2 and 6-year-old children, as they rattled 11 bullets into him and just gunned him down in cold blood. They then, in turn, took off out the house. They didn't know that his mother had bolted with the probation officers upstairs and grabbed the phone and called the police. Then she's a small woman. She just ran out of the house between them, and they couldn't control it. So she was outside. They run out the door, the two probation officers that murdered him, goes to the car and gets something that the neighbors that were looking, say, was metal, but they couldn't really tell what it was. The intern runs back to the house to go back in, not knowing that also neighbors had called the police, and then, you know, with so many calls about gunshots, the police responded in record time. Mm. They responded in 3 minutes or less. As the police entered the scene, the probation officers tried to go back into the basement, and they said, no, this is a crime scene. Nobody goes back into the basement. They said, well, we left something out here. We have to go and get it. Mm-hmm. They said, no. They yellow-taped the area, said nobody is returning into that basement. We think that what they had gone and gotten was what they call throwaway gun to set up the circumstances as though he would he was firing at them, because their story is that he fired two shots at them.
Now, these are the kinds of stories that we'll be hearing this weekend in Philadelphia. Just to clarify, is this a situation that you yourself witnessed, or are you piecing the story together from what your family have said?
Well, this is from what my family said, because I was minutes away, and I got there, you know, as the police were still in the house.
Great. Thank you. We'd like you to keep on the line, and we're going to talk next to one of the organizers of this weekend's event. Sobukwe Mbambata is the editor of Burning Spear, the official newspaper of the Africa People's Socialist Party. You're going to be up here in Philadelphia this weekend, Sobukwe. What exactly do you have in mind?
Well, no, I'm not going to be in
Philadelphia. Oh, I thought you were coming on up here.
Oh, no, no. The chairman of the African People's Socialist Party will be in Philadelphia this weekend.
Okay. So what have you got planned in any case?
Well, the tribunal is just part of a process of that the Uhuru movement is involved in all around the country and pushing back what we understand is a policy of police containment that has resulted in incidents just like the murder of Kenneth Griffin taking place on a daily basis all over this country. It's an intensifying situation. And the reality is that, you know, the African community inside the U.S. is engaged in a serious fight for its future. In every arm of the U.S. government, both major parties of the white ruling class inside this country are involved in carrying out a policy of police containment against African people inside this country. It's a policy that has the government building prisons on a massive scale all over this country, building a more militarized arsenal of police and police agencies, and generally unleashing a war against young African people all over this country. And it's a conscious, deliberate policy of police containment that's being implemented. It's government policy, and this is what is resulting in police murders, police brutality, and what has become, you know, a serious escalation in incidents just like this. And the reality is all of this is taking place at the same time that the basic democratic and social gains that African people won during the 60s are being taken away. Welfare, social programs, affirmative action, all kinds of voting and democratic gains that were won through the black struggle of the 60s are being taken away, and what's being put in place is a policy of police containment. This is the official government program on how to deal with black people inside this country. And
so, Sobukwe Mbambata, I'd like to ask you, why have you chosen Philadelphia as the site for this national activity?
Well, we've chosen Philadelphia as a site because what's been happening in Philadelphia is that because of work that the Uhuru movement has done over the last several years around cases like this case with Kenneth Griffin, Dante Dawson, who was recently murdered by the Philadelphia police last month, and what has happened in Philadelphia is that as a consequence of these struggles, there's been an upsurge inside the African and Puerto Rican community. And people are coming and becoming involved in political life. People are demonstrating. People are outraged. People are eager to do something about it.
Is there a relationship between this activity in Philadelphia demonstration that is planned for Saturday in support of Mia Abu-Jamal?
Well, yes, and the reality is that the program and this campaign that we're involved in around police brutality is one that recognizes that, first of all, what we have happening in this policy of police containment is a policy of counterinsurgency that's being implemented by the U.S. government. And this counterinsurgency is one that is immediately tied to the U.S. government war that broke the back of the Black Revolution of the 60s, that murdered countless Black freedom fighters all over this country, hunted down and murdered Black Panthers, crushed the Black Panther Party, put Black militants and revolutionaries all over this country in jails and prisons and chased others out of this country. Well, Mia Abu-Jamal, his frame-up and his attempted murder was part of that process of wiping out the Black Revolution. And this,
So, Bukwe, I want to take a moment now to give, before we end up and run out of time, the number for people who want more information and some more details about demonstrations taking place this weekend. So I'm going to have to cut you short there, but I'd like to thank you, Sobukwe Bambata of Burning Spear. You're in St. Petersburg, Florida, but the director of the Africa People's Socialist Party will be in Philly this weekend. The action we've been discussing takes place this Saturday and Sunday. On Sunday is the African People's Tribunal. On Saturday, an emergency demonstration in Philly called by the International Concerned Family and Friends of Mia Abu-Jamal to protest his execution. On the 1st, you can call 215-724-3535. That's for the tribunal. 215-724-3535. For the 2nd, the Mumia rally, you can call in New York 212-330-8029, 212-330-8029. Or in Philly, 215-476-8812, 476-8812. You've been listening to Democracy Now! I'd like to thank all of you who sent in your faxes that you sent to the Nicaraguan ambassador in response to yesterday's program. Keep them coming. If you want a copy of today's show, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-735-0230, 1-800-735-0230. And you can find us and the organizations we've mentioned on the web at www.pacifica.org, www.pacifica.org. Sitting in for Amy Goodman, who will be back with you on Monday, I'm Laura Flanders with Juan Gonzalez here in New York for Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!